Good afternoon and welcome to Daleks, brought to you by the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2. Hello to people in Birmingham on Unity FM, 93.5, and Radio Verulam in St Albans, no less. This week on the show, our guests are Robin and Caroline from the Bristol Animal Rights Collective. They're a local group who campaign against cruelty to animals and also educate and inform people about veganism. I'll be catching up with them and asking about their latest campaigns. We also have Paul Barnett, the Cultural Change Manager from Bristol City Council, who will be talking about the soon-to-be-established Bristol Music Trust. What's that, we ask ourselves. We've also got a feature from our roving reporter, Anthea Page, who's on holiday, about the Bristol and Beira link. Beira being Mozambique's second city and one of the places Anthea is currently visiting on her tour there. In addition, we also have episode 4 of Nick Payne's A Nomadic Tale. And Jess Barks has another What's On and a Song of the Week. Well, my name is John Peters Coleman, and it's a pleasure to introduce Robin and Caroline from the Bristol Animal Rights Collective. Hello.
Hiya.
Hello.
So, how long has the Bristol Animal Rights Collective been a going concern?
It's probably been going for about 5 or 6 years with different people involved in it. So, I've personally been involved for a couple of years.
I only joined in May.
Yes, and there's other people that have been around for a little bit longer. So, probably about 5 or 6 years.
Okay. So, tell me, Robin, were you sort of really interested in animal rights before you became aware of the collective, or...?
I was raised vegetarian, I've never eaten meat in my life, and I was always very interested in animal rights. I did a few sort of occasional things on my own back in Corsham. I used to go out into Bath fundraising for different campaigns and things like that, and then I saw an advert for Bristol Animal Rights Collective that got me interested. I went to one of their meetings and very shortly after turned vegan and got really, really involved and now dedicate most of my time to it.
Right, okay. What sort of makes your collective unique compared to... I mean, there are already animal rights organisations like the PETA, People Eating Tasty Animals, as I'm often told it sometimes stands for.
Well, all of us are volunteers. We're very locally based. I'd say that we're abolitionists, so we're very much for animal rights and feel that there shouldn't be any compromise. So some of the larger national groups have, I suppose it would be more of a compromise approach where they might say that it's okay for animals to be killed if they're killed humanely, whereas we're very much against any exploitation of animals.
Particularly PETA as well, they promote vegetarianism a lot more than they ever mention veganism, which is only half the struggle because the dairy industry and eggs and things like that are incredibly exploitative and cruel as well. Mm. And then there's the issue with PETA objectifying women, but that's a personal issue with them rather than...
Right, OK. I noticed you used the word abolitionist. I mean, in Bristol particularly, the immediate thing that comes to mind is obviously the abolition of slavery. I mean, do you see it in a similar way?
In a way, yes. So I do see animals as exploited by people, just in a similar way to the way that slaves were exploited by people.
It's quite common, like, if you see people from animal rights involved in court cases and things like that, it'll always be compared, because it is the same basic principle, like racism and things like that have always been sort of characterised by cruelty and exploitation, and that's exactly what animals experience, the same way women did, the same way the slaves did, and it's just another battle, another movement in motion.
Well, as a moral argument or debate, I mean, you could go sort of some way down that for quite a long time, but I suppose let's sort of focus on the veganism versus vegetarianism, I suppose, on a more practical, everyday level. Why would you say, you know, dairy is so bad? I mean, dairy is actually, you know, quite good, it's full of protein, and that could be quite difficult to incorporate a lot of in your diet, can't it?
Actually, it's really easy to get protein through other sources. I mean, you can get protein even from wholemeal bread, but nuts, tofu, lentils...
beans is a big one.
Beans is a huge, really good source of protein. And in fact, in the West, a lot of people have too much protein in their diets. And studies show that vegetarians, in fact, vegans, have as high levels of protein as people that eat meat. So protein deficiency isn't an issue amongst vegans.
I've known vegans who've been told by doctors they have too much protein and things like that as well. So it's not an issue on any level. It's a lot easier for us to digest in the form of beans and things like that as well, rather than ridiculously concentrated in meat and dairy products.
What do you think about the public image of veganism and animal rights? Because you mentioned sort of cases coming to the public light, and some animal rights people are quite extreme, and animal rights can seem like a bit of a clique of nutters almost.
And actually a lot of us are very fluffy. and I think the media does spin things out of proportion. A lot of animal rights groups are very successful, which is really good, and have caused, I'd say, economic damage to some large companies. And because the media is quite profit-driven and wants to keep those companies on their side, the media can be very biased. Mm. So I think the media actually portrays quite a negative view of animal rights for that reason.
Okay, what are your thoughts on the Hunterdon Life Science protesters and their recent sentences?
I have utmost respect for them. All they're doing is standing up for those who can't stand up for themselves, trying to save lives of many animals that are destined to suffer and die inside that hellish place. And animal testing has no benefit to us whatsoever, and I completely support them.
And they've also gone down for damaging property. And if you think what kind of sentences someone might get for GBH... they might get 6 months if you sort of compare the length of sentences to so it shows that maybe property is valued more highly than people.
Many cultures and peoples around the world will be unable to practice veganism. Does this mean that they are sort of morally inferior in some way? I mean, not a lot of people aren't going to be able to obey a meat-free diet.
No, I'd never say that they'd be morally inferior. I think in the West we have got so many choices, and we should make the most of the fact we have got those choices, so we can so easily be vegan. I wouldn't ever say that someone who wasn't able to be vegan was morally inferior.
But what you were saying there, a lot of people also say that, because you were saying about in the West, a lot of people say it's like a middle class, rich people thing, people who have money, but it's actually a lot cheaper to be vegan as well.
Yeah.
Meat and dairy are considerably more expensive than any sort of vegetable based diet. Mm. So it is, we are lucky to have that choice, and we should utilize that.
What are your thoughts about sort of veganism in sort of less well-known aspects in terms of sort of clothing? I mean, the most obvious, I suppose, would be leather shoes and stuff like that, obviously. I mean,
yeah.
What are your sort of campaigns to try and raise awareness about that?
We have had campaigns in the past against fur. So last year we had a big campaign locally against a shop called Cruise, which it was in Cabot Circus, and the company sold fur, so we had regular demonstrations outside the shop, and they're quite lively demonstrations. But that shop stopped selling fur; they issued a fur-free policy.
Okay.
They've actually closed down now, but that's.
I mean, I have a friend, for example, that found an old fur coat that was sort of 100 years old, and she said, "Well, it's already been sort of made 100 years ago. I may as well wear it and put it to good use. What's the problem with that?" I have debated this with her. What would you say?
Yeah. Personally, I wouldn't wear it, just because I think it would freak me out, the idea of wearing fur. And also I think you're still promoting an animal product, so if you looked really amazing in that fur coat, it might encourage other people to buy fur. So I think it's still promoting it. I mean, I would never campaign against, I wouldn't ever, you know, sort of say to someone you shouldn't be wearing that fur coat, but if it was a 100 years old one, but I wouldn't personally do it.
Right.
Okay. Same with secondhand leather, although a lot of people when they first become vegan might still wear their old leather clothes until
you think continue wearing it.
But I wouldn't. But I think continuing to wear it still gives off. It still makes
it socially acceptable.
It makes it look socially acceptable.
Right. Tell me a little bit about your current campaigns. I understand you have a campaign related to lions from circuses and the Noah's Ark Zoo Farm campaign.
Yeah,
what's that all about?
Yeah, that's right.
Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, there was an undercover investigation done there last year, I think.
Yeah.
By, was it CAPS who did it?
Yes,
the Captive
it was, yeah.
Animals Protection Society. And they exposed them for, they were breeding tigers for the Great British Circus, which is one of two circuses in the UK to still use animals. And yeah, it was horrible. They had a tiger on loan from there as well. And there was many other problems with them as well.
And BEASA, who are the trade zoo and aquaria trade body, revoked their licence because of their connections with the Great British Circus. And there were also other things, like they were killing off some of the animals over the winter months to save on the feeding costs.
And they weren't keeping adequate vet records of the treatment. And they weren't getting adequate vet treatment for their animals either.
Because they're meant to have monthly vet visits, they weren't having that. So since then, there have been demonstrations almost every Saturday outside the zoo.
North Somerset,
so it's in Wraxall. North Somerset Council did an investigation and put 7 extra conditions onto their licence.
Do you want to give a number for if people want to come on the demonstrations? Yeah. That would be good.
Yeah, if anyone wants to join us. I mean, the demonstrations are every Saturday from 10 to 1. And the number's 0779 489 1226. I'll say that again. It's 0779 489 1226. And we always really welcome new people to come along. So that would be fab.
Okay, I suppose normally at this point in the interview, I'll say, well, you know, what should people do if they want to get interested? I suppose obviously take up veganism would be the obvious response.
Yeah.
But what would you say to any sort of people who are thinking about it? But like, well, I don't know. Do I want to be a part of this sort?
We have a vegan buddy system set up where you can contact us, and we'll sort of put you in contact with one person who'll offer support and advice.
Okay, who can I get the
details there?
Should I give the details there?
Yeah,
The email address is veganbuddybristol@googlemail.com. The phone number is 0759574541, and the website is veganbuddy.org.uk.
All right, well, Robin and Caroline, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Do you mind if I also give the Bristol Animal Rights Collective website
as
well?
Yeah, please do.
So www.bristolanimalrights.org.uk. And for anyone who's listening to this on Sunday, there's going to be a film screening on Sunday night at Kibelli Social Centre, which is on Robertson Road in Easton. And it's at 6:30 for food, a nice vegan meal. And at 7:30, the film screening of Bold Native, which is a film about animal rights. And it's a feature-length film, but it's a free film screening.
It's not a preachy
welcome.
Film either. It's like done Hollywood style, and it's really, really good.
Okay, cool. All right, thank you very much. Bristol's town twinning link with Beira in Mozambique celebrated the 20th year of its founding with a special meal at the Rosebank Centre, Bristol. Reporter Anthea Page was there to find out more about the association and the help it provides in a practical way for the people of Mozambique. So we'll start with the Mozambique National Anthem.
Rosebank Centre, and it's the 20th anniversary of the Bristol Beira link that's with Mozambique, and I'm here with the treasurer of the association. Hello,
my name's Steve Strong. I've been the treasurer of the Bristol link with Beira since it started 20 years ago.
Can you tell us why it started? Something to do with apartheid, I believe.
Yeah, Bristol had a very proud record of fighting against apartheid in a variety of different ways. It had the second biggest anti-apartheid movement in the country after London. And as apartheid was crumbling around the time Mandela was being freed from prison, we'd been doing some discussing how we were going to carry on supporting South Africa and the states affected by apartheid. And one of the things we decided to do was set up a twinning link with Beira, which is in Mozambique, which is next door to South Africa.
Why Mozambique in particular?
Mozambique was heavily affected by apartheid in various ways. The South Africans dominated the area economically. Many people from Mozambique went to work in South Africa and were treated very badly. Many young men left Mozambique to work in the mines and other places, and the effects on Mozambique was quite significant. As apartheid was being defeated, one of the things that happened in Mozambique was a civil war that lasted for many years, which involved very significant damage to the country and to the people. And we just wanted to find somewhere where we could do some practical help. And Beira is about the same size as Bristol in population terms. It's a big port, an important port. So we thought there were things about Bristol that we might be able to identify with Beira in a helpful way.
Is there any problem because of the language? Because they speak Portuguese in Mozambique?
Yes, it hasn't been always easy, but increasing numbers of Mozambicans speak English, which has been very helpful. And what many people don't know is that Mozambique actually applied to join the Commonwealth as well. It wasn't one of the British colonies, but because it was surrounded by ex-British colonies, it became a member of the Commonwealth. So increasingly, English is a language that everyone is using. But some of our members are Mozambicans or Portuguese-speaking. So one way or another, we've been able to manage the communication over the last 20 years.
What practical ways have you been able to help the people of Mozambique?
Well, there's a long list, really. A number of Bristol schools are linked directly with schools in Beira. We've sent containers full of computers and school equipment, sports kit. We have supported important local organisations, an organisation called Amai Musenani, which means, I think, the power of women or the voice of women, which is a women's organisation which also looks after orphans of AIDS families. So we've been able to directly support their work, I mean, pay their rent on their premises, for example. My own area of particular interest is working with disabled people. We're supporting a couple of local organisations to help them support families of disabled children. And the project I've just been talking about, which is where we've been helping people learn how to manufacture wheelchairs and set up businesses to make wheelchairs for all the people affected by mobility problems in Beira and Mozambique.
There's the terrible problem of people being mutilated by war and landmines that are still relevant in the country.
Yes, it has been a big problem, thankfully less so these days. Many people were badly affected by the landmines and have lost legs, people of all ages, particularly people in rural communities. And the wheelchair project is a small contribution to making those people's lives better. We are fortunate in getting some funding from local trust funds, but we could do an awful lot more if we had more resources. Bristol City Council got a twinning website when there's a brief mention of our work, but we're working on a website at the moment which will give people information about our work and also give people a chance to join in and help us in whatever way they can.
So one final question. Have you been to Mozambique yourself?
Yes, I'm going in January and it'll be my fourth visit. And it is a fantastic country. The people, I know it's cliches, but the people there are very warm and friendly and welcoming. They are creative. Many people live in very poor circumstances, but they are positive and forward-looking people who want to improve their country. And we're very welcome as friends who help them do it on their terms.
That was Anthea Page talking to Steve Strong, treasurer of the Bristol-Beira Twinning Link with Mozambique. Now it's time for some music, and this is Staple It Together by Jack Johnson from the album In Between Dreams.
Held off the list of things he gotta do. It's really no good. He's moving on before he step it took, go from the places that it did, cause he forgot to look. Better staple it together and call it fair weather. 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 Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you could say that he don't even know where to begin, cause he looked both ways, but he was so afraid, digging deeper through the ditch every chance he missed, and the mess he made. Cause hate is such a strong word, and every brick he laid, a mistake they say, that his walls are getting taller, his world is getting smaller. Better staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather.
It's been a pleasure to introduce a man named Paul Barnett. He is the cultural change manager from Bristol City Council. Hello.
Hello, hello.
And very relaxed and easy look too, which is always good. Right, tell me a little bit about what it is to be a cultural change manager. What does that look like? That's quite an imposing title. What does that mean?
I suppose it is, in a way. It could mean a lot of things, couldn't it? And it's partly about not looking like a traditional council worker, if that's what you were worried would walk in the room today. I think what happened last year is that Bristol elected a new council, and very soon afterwards the new administration, the city council, decided they wanted to do things differently. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they've decided to do is to look hard at whether they should carry on running services inside the council or get more of them out into the power of local people.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what the previous administration did, per se, culturally. What does that really mean?
Well, over the last 10 years, Bristol's invested an awful lot of time and money in building up culture across the city, and you can see the benefits of that now in terms of, well, for example, some of the new buildings that have just opened or are just about to open. Yep. So the new extension of Colston Hall, which is a £20 million investment, the new museum, which opens next year, M Shed. New libraries, new cultural centres in St Paul's and Easton, and other parts of the city. And as part of that, the council had a very lively and dynamic cultural department, which provided services directly, and as well as investing in services that other people were providing through grants to arts organisations and so on.
Yeah.
But I think the change now is that there's definitely a view that it's probably time that some of those services, at least, are not run by the council anymore.
Okay, so is this really part of sort of the coalition's cuts? Is this a way of dressing that up?
Well, no, because this philosophical change, if you like, came as a result of the election last year. So well in advance of any discussion about this year's budget reductions or the government's big society debate, I was actually asked to do a report last summer for the politicians on what could be externalised and ways of doing it. And as a result of that, we've now set up the Cultural Change Office,
right,
which is looking at what's happening around the country, what can Bristol learn from how other people have done it, and can we design something that really works for Bristol?
Okay, so how do you think Bristol is doing compared to a lot of the other big cities in terms of how we're trying to cultivate culture, especially in terms of economic value, in terms of a lot of the people at Arden, for example, who've invested heavily in basing themselves here?
Well, cultural business is booming in Bristol. We've got a fantastic creative economy here, second only to London in the UK. And what's interesting is I go around the country and talk to people who've done similar things in Liverpool or Birmingham or Glasgow, and I'm trying to learn from what they've done. And they end up, at the end of every interview, they say, but if only we could have a bit of what you've got in Bristol. There's something in the water in Bristol,
right,
that is different from the rest of the country, and other people want a slice of it.
Right. So what do you think makes that sort of aura that Bristol has? It's sort of anarchic creative edge.
Yeah, we're a Bolshie lot, aren't we? And I suppose, yeah, you know, that goes back hundreds of years. Yeah. Bristol's always been a bit like that. And certainly, if you buy into the culture of Bristol, you're not buying into doing things in a traditional way, are you?
No.
It's about having space to do things your way, at your own pace, and we could have a whole debate about whether the Bristol pace is quick enough, but it certainly produces extraordinary creativity, which takes the world by storm. And the music scene in Bristol has been doing that, obviously, for 30 years now. But I think it's only just becoming recognised as a powerhouse of the local economy and of course, of quality of life in the city. And that's why the council's investing so much time and effort and money in trying to actually get it right.
OK, so how are you going to get the private sector involved in encouraging creative economy, creative companies?
Well, the first thing is, of course, to remind people that the private sector includes a whole lot of musicians who are actually very good at business as well. One of the things about Bristol is we've got a load of global companies based here, working across the world with a fantastic reputation. People in Bristol don't know who they are.
Right.
And I think if we do anything else for the Music Trust, it can nail the lie that artists and musicians don't know how to do business.
Okay.
So, it doesn't need to be a banker and a solicitor coming along to tell the musicians how to run things. Musicians can do that for themselves.
Okay. Is this part of where the Bristol Music Trust comes in?
Yeah. So the conclusion we came to was, let's get the Colston Hall out of the council into the hands of people who can devote their time and energy and skills to running it better than it's run now, especially after the 20 million investment. But that would be too easy in a way. That's what other cities have done, just set up a trust to run their concert hall. What we decided was Bristol actually deserves something which is about developing and supporting music of all kinds everywhere in the city. And so the Music Trust has been set up by the council. We've been recruiting trustees for the last few weeks. And it will be given the contract to run Colston Hall from April 2011.
Right. How do you think or hope their agenda might sort of change or evolve as a result of being given that independence? What would you hope to see?
Well, there's so many things, aren't there? One of the interesting things will be to see what difference does it make when you actually put the artist in charge of the venue. Doesn't often happen. I mean, if you think about the Fleece,
it's an experimental edge to that, by the sound of it.
Well, it's a bit Bristol as well, isn't it? Let's try it differently. It's already happened. The Fleece has just been taken over by the Blue Aeroplanes.
Yes.
Okay. So they're having to put their money where their mouth is, and that's going to be very interesting, isn't it? They're a very, very committed bunch of musicians, and they're now running a venue. And what they're saying is quite laudably, we want to support other musicians and run a venue that doesn't rip people off, but actually invests back into the business.
Okay, how are you expecting them to be sort of financially solvent once you've made them independent? How are they going to fund themselves?
Well, the first thing to say is that the council is going to continue funding the Bristol Music Trust to run the Colston Hall, and it's going to carry on at the current level, so it's not about cuts. But what it expects the Music Trust to do is to be able to find other sources of income that the council can't find.
Right.
There aren't a lot of people who want to give the council grants.
This is where the sort of creative connections come in and the way of thinking about things.
Yeah, partly that and partly getting other people to sponsor musicians and music. And there are a lot of people who want to do that, but they don't want to give the council the money to do
okay,
that.
So what is it within the Bristol Music Trust's remit is sort of flexible in terms of you'd be looking for them to be able to think creatively about what could be within that remit?
Yeah, so the principles of the trust, the aims and objectives that have already been agreed by the council are to promote Bristol globally through its music scene, to support the music industry in the city, and crucially to make sure that music education is at the heart of schools and education system across the city.
Okay, how would you like to see that being done compared to the way it is now in terms of, there are a lot of economic differences between marked areas, very marked, for example, Stapleton Road versus Clifton. We've famously got a lot of Jamaican and Asian immigrants of all sorts of nations. How would you like to see them getting more involved?
Yeah, that needs to be reflected on every level of the new organisation, doesn't it? So the board of trustees who run this trust must be diverse, must represent the people of Bristol, and the music that it showcases and support must do the same. So, for example, Jamaican Independent, it's 50th anniversary 2012. I expect the Music Trust to get right behind that and work with the local Jamaican community to actually trace the origins of the whole Bristol music scene from early Jamaican music through to what we're hearing now globally as the Bristol sound.
Okay, well, this is sort of like a factory record style wonderful idea that might go belly up with lots of debt. What if it goes wrong? Are you going to feel a bit egg on face or...?
Well, like everything we do in Bristol, we've got to try something to see if it works.
Yeah.
I can't believe that we can't make this successful with the support of people across the city who love music. Of course, there's always a fail-safe, and the fail-safe is that the council won't let the Colston Hall close. If the trust did get into difficulty in years to come, council would support it and bring the hall back into public management again. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Does that sort of mean that you're going to be looking over the trust's shoulder quite a lot?
No, the council, the only thing the council will retain is the freehold of the building.
Right.
everything else will be down to the trust. They will be able to make all their own decisions on what they do, how they do it, and how they promote music in the city.
Okay. What else in terms of cultural change are you thinking about, apart from just sort of music and the Bristol Music Trust?
Okay, well, the other big thing that I'm working on at the moment is the Bristol Legacy Commission, which almost feels like a whole other discussion in itself. But you were talking about abolition earlier on the programme, and obviously the Legacy Commission has come out of the work that Bristol did in 2007 on the Abolition 200 programme.
Yes.
And as a result of that, the council has set up a legacy commission made up of nine local people who are championing a transformation of services in health, in education and culture for black and Asian communities in the city.
Okay, in what ways are they changing it? What way do you feel that services are currently lacking, so to speak?
Well, a good example is the education system, which has been letting black people down in Bristol for generations. We've now got a new action plan, which is going to be a joint proposal by the council and local communities, and is going to be managed and overseen by those local communities. So for the first time, people will get a chance to shape the kind of education system they want to see in the city and make sure that the people who are delivering it actually do deliver it.
Okay, brilliant. Well, how can people find out more about this? Because unfortunately, we don't have a lot more time to go into it in detail.
Come to our website at colstonhall.org. You'll find a section about the future, and that spells out what the Bristol Music Trust is all about and how people can get involved. There'll be lots of opportunities for people to get involved, and the Trust will be up and running by April.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Paul Barnett, and that was very interesting, and let's look forward to a happier future.
Thanks, John.
Well, here we go, from a long time ago. This was Ocean Colour Scene and The Day We Caught the Train.
Never saw it as the start. It's more a change of heart. Rapping on the windows, whistling down the chimney pot. Blowing up the dust in the room where I forgot. I laid my plans in solid rock. Stepping through the door like a troubadour, while in just an hour away. Looking at the trees on the roadside, feeling it's a holiday. You and I should ride the coast and wind up in our favorite coast just miles away. Roll another, ride another song like Jimmy heard the day by the train. Oh, la, la. Oh, la, la. Oh, la, la. Oh, la, la. Sipped another rum and coke, told a dirty joke. Walking like Groucho, sucking on the number 10. Cigarette buns walked in. I miss the crush and I'm home again. Stepping through the door with a night of star wine just an hour away. Stepping to the sky and the star bright, feeling it's a brighter day. You and I should ride the coast and wind up in our favorite coast just miles away.
Well, that was The Day They Caught the Train, and by Ocean Colour Scene. We're back on the road again with Nick Payne as we rejoin him on his nomadic tale.
time had come for me to move on from Zurich, both physically and emotionally. It had become an important hub for me as a source of financial and social support. But my perspective on what constitutes a quality life was changing radically. The unbelievable affluence lent an air of unreality to both the people and the city. A bit too good to be true, with their whole fabric of life drenched in a generous helping of complacency and a sense of entitlement. Rather like the fatted rabbits in Watership Down. Their rather deluded attitude was best demonstrated to me when a good friend of mine, Nicky, an opera singer from South Africa, agreed to join a protest march through the Zurich streets to free Angela Davis. She rolled up in her bright red Alfa Romeo sports coupe, wearing a fabulously expensive fur jacket, and tootled alongside for a while, chatting away from her splendid cockpit. She soon became bored and sped off to go shopping for outfits, leaving us with a theatrical wave and wishing us a happy march. As Orson Welles famously said in The Third Man, whilst the rest of Europe struggled through centuries of wars and strife, producing the music, architecture, art and literature of the Renaissance, in 600 years of independent pacifism, Switzerland produced the cuckoo clock. It is said reality bites. It sure felt like that as Simon and I stood at the side of the road in the December snow, clothed in old fur coats bought from charity shops in England and clutching our boat fare. We were aiming for Piraeus in southern Greece, a stone's throw from Athens. The first night as Simon played guitar and we both sang some James Taylor numbers in a cafe, one of the patrons got talking to us and offered us his very plush and warm garage to sleep in. We were also well fed, and as I settled into my sleeping bag, I felt strongly the romance of being a traveller on the road with no real sense of time, purpose or direction. Just a real good feeling of being free. I was getting to live the dream. Shades of Jack Kerouac. We made slow progress through Switzerland and Austria, and late one night as we shuffled through a snow-bedecked and slumbering village in the Tyrol, a door burst open and golden light streamed out onto the snow. A fierce and commanding Balkan was almost demanding that we enter, and we were ushered into the presence of half a dozen grim-faced men sitting in a small, smoke-filled room. One pointed to Simon's guitar and ordered him to play. He broke into his well-rehearsed James Taylor routine, but was cut short by one of the party objecting. "Why are you playing that music? There are no women here." We soon left this strangely aggressive bunch, a little bemused but grateful for the company, and ambled off into the night. I later understood that they were not being overly aggressive. That is how Balkan men communicate with each other. By the following evening, we were still stuck high in the Dolomite Mountains. The romantic idyll was evaporating fast, and the cold was beginning to eat into us. Traffic was light and irregular, so we built a fire and took it in turns to stand on the highway, whilst the other stayed warm. We had been given some Swiss Army rations by a friend, along with a billy can, so we filled this with snow and chopped up the dried meat and vegetables and cooked a stew. The meat was a tad underdone, but it tasted delicious. With the cooking done and the stew warming our bellies, we stoked up the fire and continued our quest for a lift. 6 hours later, we had not advanced 1 meter down the road. The snow continued to fall, and our little fire had now become a blazing inferno. We had nothing to chop the wood with, so we heaved on whole branches, and the edifice now reached over 6 foot tall. The stillness was eerie, as it was now well into the night, and had we not felt so desperate, I am sure that we would have mustered more appreciation for our beautiful surroundings. Things were not looking too good for our intrepid travellers. I have experienced homelessness a number of times in my life. One such time I was walking past Buckingham Palace, rueing my fate, and with my mood probably registering on my face. A huge African chief was walking towards me, resplendent in a flowing green silk costume, with a matching silk bonnet and three females in tow some 5 paces behind. As he came abreast, he stopped, held his arm aloft, and without looking at me in a deep booming voice which I could not fail to miss, solemnly affirmed, "First you have to exhaust your own ability, and then to help come." He walked on by and left me incredulous and rooted to the spot on the pavement. I felt that a superior power was somehow giving me advice, and I was grateful for the understanding those words gave me. I have tried to live up to its ethos ever since. Marooned here as we were in freezing conditions was a time to call on that wise counsel. Hitchhikers evolve their own personal codes of behaviour, whiling away the waiting hours and trying to come to terms with their lack of success. All manner of superstitions and practical considerations help him to determine the most favourable place to stand to ensure the best possible result. Can the driver see you in time for him to register your request? Has he space to stop safely without impeding following traffic? Is it better to extend your left or your right thumb? The pattern would be varied from time to time in the hope of changing the luck. Once committed to being underway, there is, of course, never the option of turning back. There is no reason to suspect that the return journey will be any easier. We felt we had observed our own rules as best as the circumstances and conditions would allow, and were at a loss to do what to do to improve our chances, when an ancient Mercedes saloon with German number plates skidded to a halt some 50 metres up the road. We ran toward the car, its engine gunning and belching smoke, a sense of euphoria speeding us on. As we opened the door, a swarthy face, gaunt with urgency, or was it anxiety, bade us jump in quick. We had barely shut the door before he slewed off, skidding in the snow as his wheels fought for traction. We sat back, relieved to be out of that place and its associate experiences. Our saviour was a Greek national, and wonder of wonders, was going to Athens. Yes, he would take us all the way. We felt ourselves to be truly blessed and allowed our bodies to relax into the warmth and promise of a long and safe ride. It soon became apparent, however, that all was not well with our driver. He seemed to be escaping something, as he would frequently peer in alarm at his rear mirror and the deserted road behind. We felt that at least the car had been stolen, and that he may even have been involved in some legal infraction back in Germany. Mind you, that was not really our concern, as we selfishly felt that as long as he kept heading south, we were well placed, and could of course leave at any time. We became a little more concerned when he stopped in a village in the dark of early morning, issued us with a petrol can and a rubber tube, and directed us to find some fuel for his thirsty engine. We skulked off around in the dark for a while until we found a suitable donor, hastily did the business, tanked up and were off again. The border between Austria and what was then Yugoslavia was observed with the customary red and white barrier across the road. This had been placed at the far end of a tunnel which had cut through the mountain. We rounded the last corner of the tunnel, the barrier in full view. Either our Greek friend didn't see it, or he had no intention of stopping, for he crashed on through and sailed off into the darkness, as if nothing had happened. Having had first-hand experience of communist border guards, we were dumbstruck at Greek man's crazy actions. Several guards emerged from huts waving weapons and angry fists. Fearing the worst, we slunk down low into the seat, the better to avoid any possible pursuant missiles, and prayed to the patron saint of travel. For some reasons, the guard didn't give chase. With pounding hearts and sinking spirits, we realised our driver seemed to have little concern for anyone's well-being, least of all his own. Should we stay and hope things might improve, or split whilst we were still in one piece? It's always difficult to abandon a lift, however scarily one's host may be driving, and so we sat back and allowed the experience to unfold. Daylight brought no further incident, though we kept a wary eye out for the authorities. Much to our amazement, Greek man pulled in to a service station and proceeded to fill up with the diesel. Our surprise was short-lived, as he nonchalantly drove off without paying. Knowing the reputation and the uncompromising harshness of the police in any communist state, we tried to persuade him to return and pay. He ignored us and sped on. Sure enough, the flashing blue light of the overtaking motorcycle cop brought us to a halt. The helmeted gangster parked his bike across our bows and strode towards us, unholstering his pistol en route. I was in the front seat, and the cop motioned with his weapon for me to wind down the window. He stuck it through the opening, aiming at my temple, and ordered us out of the car. No plastic toy, this one. The huge muzzle, inches from my head, looked formidably real and potent. Greek man hissed his response. "You grab the gun and I'll drive off." "Like hell you will," I screamed back. "You'll get out of the car nice and easy, and you'll do whatever this thug asks of you." He reluctantly complied, and after some haggling between the two, he agreed to return to the garage, where he paid the full amount. Once again, we were a little nonplussed as to why we were allowed to proceed without further action, but we thanked our lucky stars, and with great relief, zoomed off. As much as we wanted to get to Piraeus, and as grateful as we were for the lift, we could hardly wait to be free of this madman. His mood still seemed fractious, and so when we finally reached the Greek border in the Kozut Mountains, we were unfazed when he ordered us out of the car. We got out and he drove off toward the frontier, leaving us stranded in the snow with our gear, mutually relieved and annoyed at the same time. Simon began to curse him for dumping us like that. I said, "Don't worry, he won't get far." I held aloft the Greek's passport, which he himself had asked me to get out from the forward glove compartment in anticipation of the border. I tossed it into the deep snow at the side of the road and felt not a twinge of guilt. Here we were again, snowbound and still 250 miles from our goal. The white stuff was settling fast, and soon all vehicles were stranded both ways out of the mountain pass. A bunch of us, exclusively American and British, did our best to dig the lead cars out of the drift with little success. All the others stayed in their vehicles, and much to our dismay, made the situation worse by trying to drive out, spinning wheels forlornly and forming impenetrable barriers of snow around everything and everyone. After some time, we gave up and spent the night in the VW camper of two of the Americans. They listened sympathetically to our story and offered us a lift to Athens. In the morning, tractor diggers arrived and cleared the road. We descended gratefully into a Greek day with clear blue skies overhead and not a sign of snow underfoot. The warm sun began to thaw out our stiffened limbs, so we stopped at the first cafe and, loosening our tightly drawn purse strings for once, tucked into coffee, croissant, yogurt, honey, fresh fruit and nuts. Totally sated, I felt the romantic idyll began to shine again in my heart, so I sat back, relaxed in the sunshine, and basked once more in our good fortune.
Thank you very much to Nick Payne there for reading us an episode of his Nomadic Tale, episode 4 there, written and read exclusively for Dialect, I would hasten to add. More of that next week. Well, here he is once again, today wearing camo trousers and a collector's item, a 16-year-old skin T-shirt, which he tells me he's wearing for the first time in those 16 years. A pleasure indeed. Hello.
Hello, John.
What's on this week?
This is a What's On guide from Dialect, starting with Friday, 19th of November, and the Doors tribute band, Doors Alive, will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance, and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also on 19th of November, Motorhead will be performing as part of their 35th anniversary tour with support from Michael Munro and also Skew Siskin at the Colston Hall in Bristol. Tickets are £26 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present David Bowie. This is from his sixth studio album, Aladdin Sane, which was released in 1973 and is the track titled Cracked Actor.
Star they are.
That was David Bowie with Cracked Actor from the album Aladdin Sane. For more information, check out www.davidbowie.com. On to Saturday, 20th of November, Cable Co will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Templegate, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, on Tuesday, 23rd of November, Sham 69 will be performing with support from Two Sick Monkeys and also Hacksaw at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, eagle-eared listeners will have noticed we have interviewed a member of Hacksaw, so the Sham 69 gig will be worth it just to see them. I'm sure they'll start a bog roll fight. Lovely jubbly. Thank you, Jeff. Well, already, time's up. That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were Robin and Caroline from the Bristol Animal Rights Collective, and we also spoke to Paul Barnett from Bristol City Council. We also had a feature from Anthea Page and Nick Payne for another episode of Nomadic Tale. More of that next week. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks, who wrote the What's On Guide. Lee Duffield was the engineer this week, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. If you'd like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
يا لا لا لو يا لا لا عيد مبارك عساكم من عوادا.